When disaster strikes, the world turns to one organization for hope, help, leadership, and coordination, the United Nations. When there is peace to keep between warring factions, the world asks the UN to mobilize peacekeepers, oversee elections, and create stability. And in the face of the challenges such as climate change, disease, or poverty, the UN provides the platform for international cooperation. But in truth, the United Nations is nothing more than a collection of countries without people like our guest, Tom Lovejoy, who gives the UN real substance and direction. Stay with me to learn more about him and the epic work he has done because of his thought leadership, his extensive scientific research, and through applied scholarship with his work in the Amazon rainforest. Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thank you for being a part of it. The guest we're about to spend the next hour with is Tom Lovejoy. He is the director at the Center for Biodiversity and Sustainability at George Mason University. He is an accomplished conservation and tropical biologist and serves as a senior fellow of the United Nations Foundation, where he advises foundation leaders on biodiversity and environmental science. Tom is known as the godfather of biodiversity, which might be because he actually coined the term. He originated the concept of debt for nature swaps, which we're going to learn about, and has worked on the interaction between climate change and biodiversity for more than, I think it's safe to say, 50 years. It said 30 in one of the things I read, but we know it's longer. So hopefully we'll have time to talk with him about quite a bit of all these big, bold, all-encompassing issues which impact all of our lives. Tom, it's so great to have you here, and I really can't wait to hear all about your journey.
Fun to be with you.
Okay, so I want to give you a sense of my feelings when I was preparing for this time together. Lots of emotions because of my connection to the rainforest, conflicting thoughts on what I'd like all our listeners to learn about you and which area of work to focus on. So I did, as I shared with you just a minute ago, what any thinking person would do. I called my very dear friend, Jim Beiser from the University of Arizona, and admitted to my whirling dervish brain. So he wanted to make sure that I say hello to you, and he really helped me with what direction I decided to take. So hello from him, and I think he should be given credit as co-producer of the show. So let's move on. But let's start with the biodiversity conversation. What was your inspiration for that phrase, especially since it's now pretty much rolling off people's tongues? I mean, it's not a new term, but in the environmental awareness world, it is very much used. And you really are described as the godfather of biodiversity. I'm sure you knew that. So how did your journey lead you to coining that phrase? How did it all come about?
So it started when I was about 14 and had an amazing biology teacher who basically taught a biology course which revolved around the variety of life on Earth, but there was no phrase for it. And, you know, as time went on and I got involved in conservation and the rest, I was not alone in sort of grasping for some way to refer to the extraordinary variety of the natural world. And so there were two others in 1980 who also used the phrase the first time. None of us thought we were actually doing something new. None of us worried about who was first.
Right.
But we just, you know, we cared about the incredible variety of nature. And one of those people was Ed Wilson, who I probably first met in the mid-1970s, and I remember the lunch we had together, and that we were actually talking about biological diversity, but we didn't have the phrase to use. And the other was Elliot Norris, who was at the Council on Environmental Quality and was the person who actually at one point went back and decided I was first by a few months.
A true researcher. I mean, seriously, to the nth degree. Look at the writing and see who said it first. That's a wonderful story. Seriously, there was no fighting over who did it first, because it now can be proven.
It shows that the instinct to publish is a good one.
Seriously. And I guess what I wonder now, I mean, 50 years, it's half a century, which makes us sound old, and we're not. But when you were doing it with other people, with Ed and with Elliot, did you have a sense then at all, an inkling about how important biodiversity would be for life on this planet today, the conversations around it? Because now it's like, I get it. I understand why the rainforests, as we destroy them, we're destroying things we don't even know that we're destroying because of the biodiversity in the rainforest. So did you have this big vision thinking, wow, this is going to serve us well forever?
Well, I'm certain that that awareness and concern was there from almost the very beginning. In people like Ed and myself, because you can't sort of be there marveling at this incredible variety of plants and animals and microorganisms and not be concerned about its future and not understand the many, many links between the natural world and the human condition, even if we know we're only aware of a portion of them.
A very small portion. And that, to me, the awareness hopefully leads to connection, which is what I constantly talk about on my platforms, is connecting with nature is where it all begins in terms of living consciously and a socially just and sustainable planet. But what about the Amazon? At what point did you know, and just expand on this as much as you want, about how important the role the Amazon rainforest would be and is on this planet today? Like, what happened that grabbed your attention and has kept the fires burning in you for over five decades? I mean, I told you about my story that just started 12 years ago, and yours began way before that, but I went, and then I got hooked. So what happened to you?
So I first went in 1965, and the truth is, I was game for any kind of scientific adventure.
Right.
And I'd actually had plans to do a PhD on montane forest birds in East Africa. And then I had a chance to go to the Amazon of Brazil in the summer of 1965. And I just never looked back. I mean, because there I was in the largest wilderness on Earth, with more biological diversity than any other place. And one couldn't just help but become entranced and then totally, you know, into the place.
So the big, bold question, and I struggled with this, and it's kind of like long, but it leads to a question that I would love you to just expand on, because it's one that I struggle with in terms of getting people to get it. Like, I want to kind of grab their face and say, please listen to me about the rainforest. But you've applied your scholarship, your wisdom, your brain trust to the Amazon, and have been referred to by many as the Jacques Cousteau of the rainforest. And that's understandable to people. You made the rainforest real. You brought it to the attention of U.S. leaders. You recognized that the impact needed to be much greater, so that you brought it into our living rooms. So I did my personal share of going there, and first the Peruvian rainforest and then in Ecuador. And I still struggle on how to make the question to you big enough, bold enough, strong enough to have you help us all understand what a vital role the rainforest plays in our lives, in our future. It's not down there. It's vitally important, perhaps more than ever. So can you answer that big, bold question, Tom Lovejoy?
Well, you know, there's some immediate practical reasons to care about the Amazon, sort of what people call utility value. And so, you know, there are important medicines that come out of the Amazon rainforest, and many more still to come. And one of those is the preferred treatment for high blood pressure. Another is quinine as the last resort cure for malaria. Another is curare, which is still harvested directly from vines in the Amazon and used as a muscle relaxant in abdominal surgery. And basically, we've just scratched the surface on that kind of utility. And just about everybody, you know, gets to enjoy chocolate every day, and that came from the Amazon.
I trust you to know I do. Fair trade.
So, but there are many things that go beyond the contribution potential are already going on of individual kinds of plants and animals, because the Amazon has the extraordinary capacity of making half of its own rainfall. And that's because the air masses move from the Atlantic to the Andes one way. And once they drop, the moisture is rain. It then gets evaporated off the complex surfaces of the forest, transpired through the leaves, and becomes rain farther to the west. So that means you actually have to manage the Amazon as a system. If you want to keep enough rain in the Amazon to maintain a rainforest. But it's also not just the Amazon that is affected by that system. It actually connects to continental climate, providing rain even as far south as northern Argentina. And, of course, it is an immense reserve of carbon in the living forest that we have every reason to keep there and not allow it to get into the atmosphere and make a bad climate change problem even worse.
So rain medicines, which I agree with you, we have not tapped, we have not even come close to tapping the secrets that can be revealed. I mean, some of the major drug companies in the world have research scientists all over it, sampling, testing, trying to find more applications for it. Because when you go to the rainforest and live with the indigenous people, they don't have any prescriptions that I noticed. It's like whatever ills you have, there's an herb for that, or there's a salve for that, or there's a plant for that. Oxygen, the temperatures of our oceans. I always wonder why it's not more of a consciousness globally, because there is a lot at stake. And I guess I don't think you can, you know, cast the magic spell on people. But in your opinion, and with all of the scholarship that you have behind you, shouldn't it be more topical in terms of everyday conversations with people? I realize that I'm a fanatic, and I know, and I get it. And I try to curate that at times, but I want to know, are you perplexed at times why it's not more of a conversation on the global arena or on the global stage? There's so much at stake.
Yeah, I wouldn't say perplexed so much as frustrated.
Okay, that's a good word. I'm frustrated too. Yes, that's a better word.
I think, you know, as a species, we're such a social primate, we easily get sort of caught up in interactions with each other and forget we're part of a larger system and indeed a living planet. And that much as one has to manage the Amazon as a system, we actually have to manage the planet as a linked biological and physical system, which sounds really arrogant. But what it really means is we have to manage ourselves so that we can safeguard and husband the wonderful aspects of this living planet in perpetuity.
And it's really not a tree hugger issue. Like, it's not like save the trees. That's a big part of it, because when you see these magnificent trees that you could literally live in or on top of some of them that I saw. You could literally just carve it out and live inside. And I know in places in Indonesia that happens, but it's so much more than the trees. I mean, it's all that goes with it. And in terms of the history and things that you've been involved in, this is kind of like a little bit of a sidebar, but Jim told me about, you know, to really do some research on the plea for a regional approach, an entity to address global change issues. And from what he told me and from what I could read, you were right in the middle of a lot of it to get the Americas to sign the agreement establishing the Inter-American Institute for Global Change Research back in 1992. What was the impetus behind it? Did it help? What happened as a result of that? Did it help countries come together? Tell us the benefit of putting effort and energy into that.
So what it really comes down to is that you're much more likely to get people to engage in an important issue if it's partly from information that comes from some local institution and from local scientists rather than from some first world NASA-like institution, you know, hundreds and thousands of miles away. And so the idea of building capacity or growing capacity, because there already was some in South America, was a very logical step. And, you know, I was happy to be helpful with all of that. And it's been a real success. And it's sort of interesting that the paper that I wrote with South America's leading climate scientist, Carlos Nobre, about the Amazon needing to be managed as a system, essentially is partly a product of having created that Inter-American Institute.
So expand on what you mean in terms of managed as a system, in layman's terms. What were you asking for?
So the issue about the Amazon, which we alluded to before, is that it makes half of its own rainfall.
Right.
And that means at a certain point, deforestation will pull the rug out from its ability to do that. Because if there aren't trees and rainforests where the rain falls, most of the water just runs off and ends up back in the Atlantic. If there are trees, it evaporates and transpires and then produces rainfall farther to the west. So basically, at some point, the deforestation in the Amazon could cause that hydrological cycle to degrade. And Carlos Nobre and I think that point is very close at hand. And so we wrote an editorial called The Amazon Tipping Point, essentially explaining that and making the additional point that even though we don't know precisely where the tipping point is, there is no sense in figuring out where it is by actually tipping
it. Right. This is not the tipping point we want to see come about.
So let's play it sensibly. And that requires managing the Amazon as a system so that hydrological cycle can function in perpetuity.
So to that, so it contributed, I get it. It played a role. It was really getting the attention. I understand. Before we go to a short break, my question then becomes, and you can tell, like, I get breathless because here's a man that lived a life that I want to know every bit about. I'm barely kidding because it's my passion. I want to go back there more, you know, on and on and on. What I struggle with is, in my passion, when I do get people's attention, what's the call to action? What do I want to ask them to do? And sometimes I say, you know, support Amazon Watch. Sometimes I say consume less. Sometimes I say find out why it matters and live consciously. But we have hundreds of thousands of people now that listen to this podcast. What's the call to action? Like, what can the general public do in terms of preservation, the vitally important rainforests around the world? Do you have that answer, Tom Lovejoy?
So it's all of the above that you mentioned and many more. It's actually trying to convince our elected officials that these are important issues for us, even though they occur on a different continent, because many of the economic links between the Amazon countries and the developed world can lead to deforestation. So we need to be very aware of the complexity of those interactions and ways that we can turn them around and make them positive.
And I went to the Global Climate Action Summit in San Francisco and spent a lot of time with the Amazon. You know, there was a contingent offsite from the Mozzoni Center, and I think it's the Moscone Center, sorry. And there were people on the main stage in the plenary sessions talking about, we are still destroying 1 acre of rainforest every second. And I'm like, where does that statistic come from? Is that really a statistically valid sample of what's happening? And is it mostly in Indonesia? It's slowed down in Ecuador, in most of Ecuador. So is that a statistic that you would say, yep, Gina, it's still that bad?
Well, you know, it varies from day to day and year to year, but it's on that order of magnitude.
Yeah, that's just...
You know, and it may have been going down in Ecuador, but right now it's been going up in Brazil. So it's a very dynamic situation.
Yeah, on any given day. Okay, we're going to take a very short break, and we come back. We're going to talk about something that Tom developed, Debt for Nature, and his role with the United Nations and what that means, and some of his National Council for Science and the Environment decision-making process. So everybody stay here with me, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. We will be right back.
Please join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. You can also find us on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and SpeakUp Radio. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or others, please write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But now, back to our story.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as always, I thank you for being here, because if you weren't, why would I be doing this? And I love the emails I'm getting and the connections on LinkedIn. It just seems like things are growing in such a wonderful direction for the importance of spreading the message about a sustainable and socially just planet. So just take a deep breath and thank yourself for helping our mission grow and expand. And you know what, everybody? We are truly blessed to be spending this hour with Tom Lovejoy. He is the director for Center for Biodiversity and Sustainability at George Mason University and serves as a senior fellow of the United Nations Foundation, where he advises foundation leaders on biodiversity and environmental science. Tom is known as the godfather of biodiversity. It's been proven by his colleagues. He's the originator for the concept of debt for nature and has worked in the Amazon rainforest in Brazil for over 50 years. And in those five decades, Dr. Lovejoy has helped bring global attention to the Amazon rainforest and the threat it faces, leading seminal research that has helped build the foundation of the field of conservation biology. So, Tom, once again, great to have you here. So, Debt for Nature, I, of course, did not pick that up until I read more about you. And then Jim Beiser said, he said, Tom invented it. He's the guy that came up with it. He designed it and he came up with the concept. So, do tell, what is the Debt for Nature concept?
Its origin in the early 1980s was the recognition that a number of countries like Brazil and Peru, et cetera, owed a huge amount of money to commercial banks, particularly in the United States, but in other countries, whether it was Spain or whatever. and that the debt itself was causing conservation problems because budgets were being cut in these countries to try and pay back the debt. And I basically wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times about all of this. And the title chosen, because you never get to choose your title if you write for a newspaper, was Save Debtor Nations apostrophe Ecology.
Right.
And basically, you know, I described all of this and said, shouldn't it be possible to turn this around and have it work the other way? And it took a while, but eventually conservation noticed what the private sector had been doing with that debt. It had basically been buying it at a discount in local currency, buying it at a discount and then redeeming it in local currency for much less. So at one point you could buy a dollar of Peruvian debt for 2 cents on the dollar. And then you could go to Peru, if that's what you were working on, and say, we will relieve you of this hard currency obligation if you would agree to apply an equal amount in your currency to some conservation project. And you basically, you could do anything with it that you could do with money. And so that did, in fact, take off. And billions of dollars of debt for nature have been done. Nobody knows how much. It's no longer news when it happens. So maybe one day a graduate student will figure that out.
And say what was the first one and give us some statistics. But can you give us an example of one that you're aware of? Do you have one that's top of mind to share with us and how it worked?
So the first one was done in Bolivia to create a national park. The lead on that was Conservation International. The second one was done in Ecuador, and it wasn't a really big one. I think it was just like $10 million worth or something of that sort. But basically what conservation got out of it was doubling the budget of the National Park Service of Ecuador for 10 years.
Wow.
And that was just the beginning, and it took off all over the place.
And talk about the win-win. It's kind of like the green trifecta, because those countries ostensibly were never going to get out from under that debt, more than likely, and it changes the whole paradigm. It shifts the whole paradigm. Would you agree with that? It's like, yeah, this is really a win-win on many fronts.
Yeah, well, you turn it into an opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was like, I read about that, and I'm thinking, yeah, I wish that kids could do that for their college debt and figure out how to turn that into something that works for nature. Maybe that will happen, and we can work on that project. So
right now, there are a lot of countries which are finding it really tough to deal with debt to China, and there's no reason China can't start doing some debt for nature, because most of the debt for nature done in the last 25 years has been government-to-government debt. So there's something new there that, in fact, China might do.
And talk about hope and inspiration. And at the climate summit, there were very highly placed politicians or government officials, more likely government officials from China. And, you know, you go to these conferences. I thought it was one of the best I've ever been to in 10 years. Lots of, you know, agreements signed. But China was of particular interest to me because there does seem to be an awareness, whether it's you know, for all the right reasons, which would mean cleaner air and, you know, renewable energy, or saving money, which China seems particularly interested in. But there was a sense that they get it. They get the climate change conversation. They get the dirty air conversation, the coal conversation. So that makes me excited that this could happen with them as well, because we certainly need to keep shifting that paradigm over there with their all their CO2 emissions and population and all that stuff. So hope for the future. Anything you'd like to add on the Debt for Nature piece before I go on to the next conversation?
Well, only that because it ceased to be news, people don't pay attention to it anymore. But in fact, should be something that any conservationist always has in his or her back pocket.
It is such a big deal. And then I went down the rabbit hole reading about it, and I thought, wow. And you're right. I mean, I know a little bit about a lot after doing this for 10 years, and what a concept. So I think we should get on the title of Godfather of Debt for Nature conversation and get Elliot and Tom in on it and say, okay, guys, who did that first? Ed and Elliot, sorry. Okay, in 2017...
So I need to tell you why I'm called the godfather of biodiversity.
I wanted to know, is it with the father? I put that first, and then I went, oh, no, it's the godfather. It's like the dawn. It was really...
Yeah, so somebody once started to introduce me as the father of biological diversity. And I said, no, that doesn't work. That's biologically impossible.
There is really some innuendo there that had to be cleared. I love it.
Yeah.
Godfather is much better. Much less potential for embarrassing situations. I love that. So in 2017, you were the recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Council for Science and the Environment. And Jim Beiser told me, he said, Gina, it's a very prestigious award. And I want to read a quote from you in a write-up that I read when I did some research on it in the Class News from Yale University. And I have to admit, I'm just going to throw this in here for a little bit of levity. I thought, be careful what they write about you everywhere, because we're showing now with the hearings for the Supreme Court justice that whatever you wrote in your yearbook or that was written about you or in Yale News might come back someday when, you know, just make sure you want everything to come back that's written about you. And I had a little bit of a chuckle. So Dr. Lovejoy strongly believes humans are inevitably connected to the rest of life on Earth, whether it's through ecosystem services or through some direct product that we are taking from nature. And I would love for you to expand on that just a bit. Given your interactions with humans on the global stage, do you think people are generally aware of what we are taking from nature every day in pretty much everything we do, whether it's oxygen or water or the clothes we're wearing or the products? What's your sense? Are people aware that it comes from somewhere? It comes from somewhere?
So some segments of humanity are. I mean, the forest peoples.
Yes, they are aware because they live
they're
it.
They're aware.
Yeah.
But is the average New Yorker at all aware when he turns on, he or she turns on the tap, that all comes from a wonderful watershed up in the Catskills? You bet they aren't. And there's a great story about all of that, which doesn't get told often enough, which is that watershed sort of suffered degradation over time, and the EPA was going to require New York City to build an $8 billion water filtration plant. And somebody had the bright idea that it would be a cheaper and more permanent solution to just restore the biodiversity and function of that watershed. And that's actually what was done, and it cost 10% of what it would have cost to build a water treatment plant. But does the average New Yorker have any clue about that? No.
And that's a perfect example what of course, has happened in my journey. Every shower I take, every time I turn the water on, I am consciously aware. And I so mean that. It's built into my DNA. And it's not a heavy feeling. It's a sense of almost joy that I'm aware of it. And I'm not standing there. If anybody, like my granddaughter, takes 20-minute showers, I'm on her. I'm like, Madison, 20-minute showers. Do you have any? What are you doing in there? Is the first thing I ask as a grandmother. But then I say, we can't keep doing that. Even in, I'm in the desert Southwest, so the awareness around water is acute for most people, because there's a possibility. So, it, like from what you said, there's a gift there if you choose to look at the origin of everything you have. And I was, you know, in the clothes I wear, when I did a whole series on the filthy fashion industry and the slavery that it involves and the cancer that it causes to the people that are making my clothes, you can be sure I don't buy $5 t-shirts at Target anymore, because I know where they come from and I don't want to bash Target, but it's great to call that out, because you don't need that $5 t-shirt for each holiday. So it's that connection that I think will help reach the right kind of tipping point. So I don't think I digress. You serve on the board for NCSE, the National Council for Science and the Environment, and it supports the scientific basis for environmental decision-making. And that's so important. And I know that, and most consciously living people know that it is based on science. But how does it translate to applied science in decision making? What kinds of decisions are made because of that science, and who's making them? Do you have a couple of examples you could share with us?
Well, actually, the New York City watershed story is a great example.
Perfect example. Yes. Yep.
There are lots of places in the world where forests are being protected or created by reforestation just for the watershed function, even though many of the people enjoying that water have no clue. So there are things like that going on all the time, and what is way below almost everybody's radar is in fact that biological diversity it's not just about carbon. It's not just about watersheds. It's also about all these organisms out there on a regular basis coming up with new solutions to their unique set of biological problems, any one of which could be transformative in the life sciences. So you need to think about biological diversity as a gigantic living library. And since most human cultures automatically value libraries, we could transfer that kind of thinking to the natural world. It might make a really big difference.
Could make a really big difference. And let's go into this a little bit deeper in terms of the applied science, because to me there's this the intersection of policy and the public. And I know I had someone on my show quite some time ago when I'm saying we were talking about plastic bags, which are, to me, they're a gateway to consciousness. If you understand where they come from, what kind of harm they cause, it's not hard to change that habit. It's just a habit, so stop it. And I said, why don't we just start a national campaign around awareness with plastic bags? And he said, never in the history of the United States has a municipality or a town or anything made the decision to stop using plastic bags. It has to be policy. So when you're involved in these, you're involved at the scientific level, and that impacts policy. Again, the public is who listens to my show. And, you know, I just got an email from someone at Biosphere 2 who's using the shows as teaching modules for her classes. That's how important the guests I have are and what their message is. So for the public, what's their role in taking it, you know, in really realizing that your decision-making is impacting this, whether it's a riparian zone? Is it important, for example, this might sound a little pithy, but to have a small garden, even if you have an apartment in New York with a balcony? Are there things that are you know, you can feel like you're at least contributing in some way, but where does the public play into this?
Well, the public in the end are the big drivers of what happens and what doesn't happen. So first and foremost, it's really important for public consciousness about all these environmental issues and biodiversity right up in front among them. Because without that awareness, thinking up possible solutions and more gentle ways in which to coexist with the rest of life on Earth just won't come forth. People have to be thinking about it and being creative about it, and that means being aware.
Yeah, that's a great note on which to take a quick break. While we take a quick break, think about your awareness level. I talk about people's environmental IQ, so we're going to take a very short break. We'll be back with more from Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. Please stay here with me.
Hi, it's Meredith, a proud member of the Mrs. Green's World team. We are disruptors for good, passionate game changers working to create a more sustainable, safer, healthier, and socially just planet for all. By creating podcasts like this one, we offer tangible solutions that inspire you to take action. We need your financial support to continue producing content, podcasts, film, and written works that engage, educate, and inspire our global community to fight climate change. Join us today. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click Join the Movement.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for listening. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as always, we thank you for being a part of it and for joining us. For this hour, we're learning about all things about the environment from Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. He is the director of the Center for Biodiversity and Sustainability at George Mason University and serves as a senior fellow of the United Nations Foundation, where he addresses foundation leaders on biodiversity and environmental science. So, Tom, once again, thanks for being here. And let's, if we could, talk a little bit about your role at the United Nations. It's like, as my co-producer Jim Beiser, those words were right out of his mouth. The UN is simply a connection of people and signed agreements unless they have substance, and people who know how to make the right investments, do the right thing, and set the right priorities. Can you talk with us a bit about how you work with the United Nations and on what kinds of issues?
So the most recent thing I did was to participate a week ago this past Sunday in New York in a group discussion about the Sustainable Development Goals.
Right.
Which most people are totally unaware of.
I know. I wear my pin and people say, oh, that's a pretty pin. What's it for? And then I have them. It's like set the hook.
So the Sustainable Development Goals were negotiated by the UN community as a way to chart and act our way forward to a much more sustainable existence on our planet. And there are 17 of them, and only three of them really are about the subjects that we're talking about today. One is called Life on Land, which is biodiversity terrestrially. Life in Water, which refers to the oceans. So presumably fresh water is included in life on land. And then the third one is about climate. And as anybody can imagine, you know, if you have 17 goals, it's really hard to manage them in an integrated fashion. And then unless you do it in an integrated fashion, some of them aren't going to get done properly or maybe done hardly at all. So this whole exercise was to try and advance all of that. So inevitably, I chaired the working group on life on land, namely biological diversity. And the main conclusion we made, okay, or we came to, was that because everything we do and anything that's an environmental problem is called that because it affects living systems. Basically, the progress with other of the Sustainable Development Goals actually needed cross links to the state of biological diversity. Just, you know, living things integrate all environmental problems. And so that's one of the more recent things I'm doing. Next week I'll be in China in discussions about the biodiversity targets that will be set in 2020 when the Biodiversity Convention meets in Beijing. And so, you know, and other duties as described.
Yeah, and to me, the I don't know how to really word this, but when you know some of the sustainable development goals, they really all have to do with preservation of the planet. If you educate girls, that helps. I mean, you know, Paul Hawkins' book, Project Drawdown, it's one of the top four, the education of girls in terms of climate change, clean water and sanitation, affordable and clean energy. There are so many of them that to me should be, they're all about climate change and awareness. I mean, sustainable cities. It's like, to me, the conversation should be couched in this is, it's the work you're doing. It's the consciousness of the rainforest, and it's integrated. You're right. They all have to be a part of the wheel. So that's my little Mrs. Green's World rant. In terms of...
Let's not... jump over the importance of women and improving the status and education of women in arriving at better outcomes.
So important. So critically important.
It's a big part of the UN Foundation program. And as I like to say, they don't call her Mother Nature for nothing.
That's exactly right. We got top billing in that way. I love it. And the role of girls. And people say, why does that matter? Well, if you have fewer children and you educate girls, it raises everything. They get educated, they have fewer children, which has a lower impact, and it becomes a win-win for everybody. So let's bring it down to, while we're recording this, we just had another devastating hurricane followed by a tsunami in Indonesia. Is there enough of a sense of tying these occurrences, which are increasing in numbers and severity? I'm sure you could scientifically prove that to me. Does it help connect people more and more to the climate change conversation, which is one part of it, and then help impact behaviors? Like, I'm watching it last night, and I'm thinking, yeah, Indonesia, they're devastating the rainforest. How's that working for you people? I don't think that's even a nice thought to have. But I can't help point out that the rainforests are the lungs of the earth, and it's a catastrophe, yes, but wake up, people. So do those things help with what you're doing and your research and applied science? Can you use them?
So I think there is some growing consciousness that the greater frequency of more intense tropical cyclones or typhoons or hurricanes, whatever you want to call them, is a direct result of climate change. Because, you know, warmer water means more energy available to turn into superstorms. The issue of the tsunami is an interesting one because, to begin with, the earthquake which generated it is basically part of the normal physical process of how the planet works. But the vulnerability of some of those communities may well have been because they destroyed the mangroves, which otherwise would have been along their shorelines and would have blunted not all of, but a significant amount of the energy in the tsunami. So even when it's something generated by tectonic plates, the biology of the planet is important for human well-being.
So well put. Like, really, people, pay attention. It's, you know, everything I read, and even the tying in the horrible forest fires that we're having here in our country that just continue to ravage and kill. And then the rains are coming from Hurricane Rosa. So the erosion and the mudslides that'll happen, that's going to be the next wave of news next week. And you know that. It's the pattern that will predict what's going to happen next. So things like this, as devastating they are, I'm always sitting there hoping it helps ignite everybody's passion about to live more consciously and get involved as part of the solution. So this is a deeper thought question, I think, about you are, I'm kind of like a Tom Lovejoy wannabe in the amount of time you get to spend in the rainforest and what you've known. And when I met you at Planet Forward in I think it was in April in D.C., Frank Sesno, it was a great presentation, all of those folks, Dan Reed, but you had like a posse around you because people, young people especially, are very interested, many of them, in what's going on in the rainforest. How did that, it got you. How does it help guide you in your thought process or your decision-making every day and help provide you with direction for the United Nations or for the scientific, you know, information that you're producing, your research? How has that helped guide you and shape you?
So I think the real question is, since almost all environmental indicators are going in negative directions, how do you cope with that? And basically what I do is I just, you know, start every day looking at it as a fresh puzzle and not sitting there and wringing my hands over things that have happened negatively in the previous day or the previous week or the previous month. I mean, there's no point in sort of rolling over and just sort of giving up.
I might have to play this again and again at times because sometimes it's like, I want to start covering the good news bears, but there is a lot. And to me, information is power. So you can use it for your own greater good or the greater impact that you have. So that's a great way to look at it. It's like, what can I do today? And with the devastating impact of global warming. So does it help, as a trusted advisor, to put it mildly, to the United Nations, does it help you advise them in terms of real solutions and policy decisions at the UN?
If basically you sort of look at this as an ongoing effort, which sort of produces fresh opportunities every day, so that you find something you can do to make a difference, then you can, in whatever small degree, contribute to a solution. And so there's no point in thinking about it any other way. It's our planet, it's our future, it's our children's future, our grandchildren's future. We just need to rise up to it.
Just, you know, that's what I say to myself, just get up, get on your feet, get up and make it happen. Because when I get like someone reaching out to me from Biosphere 2 saying they use the podcast, when you're in my world, you can count number of listens. And what our team would love to do is count impact on behaviors, because we're not doing it, you know, as Seth Godin says, not to increase all of our numbers wildly, but to provide quality, trusted information to the people that do care enough to listen. So it's, yeah, that's what you need to do. You need to be a part of the solution, and we can't look back, because sometimes if we look from where we were to where we are right now, it's not always good news. So speaking of grandkids, you have some. Do you have conversations with them about this, about shape the climate is in? Do they want to talk to you about it? What are they talking to you about? Our future. They are our future. What are they asking or talking about?
Well, you know, they basically all get it. My kids get it, so my grandkids get it. And it's just part of what being a normal concerned citizen is about. You know, each in their own way is off making a difference.
And that's important. But then there's the conversation, like you said, it's part of you know, it's part of their reality. But the other part is that the impact is so much harsher, earlier, more severe in many cases on marginalized communities. It's, we haven't touched on that. But in the general awareness that I feel in my world, lots of people are aware of it. They might be making changes in behavior to help things from progressing, but they're really not aware that there are literally thousands of people already feeling the impact, that are starving to death, that don't have access to clean water, whose habitats are being flooded. The mayor of Honolulu talked about it at the Global Climate Action Summit. He said, you know, we have the rich people on the one side of the island with 40-foot shoreline, so they're not worried about the water rising. But then we have the other side of the island where they're already having to move, and where do they go? So is there an awareness? You know, we have white privilege. I don't know what else to call it. It's not a race issue, but we were born with a set of advantages. So what are the conversations around that? So much of the UN, the sustainability goals, to me, do address that. But what is your sense of the consciousness of this hurts some people a lot more than others?
So that's the topic of environmental justice.
Yes.
It's important to think of it not only in terms of how these environmental problems more impact underprivileged communities than privileged ones. It's also important to think about it through time. And when you start doing that, what you realize is that what we're doing to the planet, through the climate, through biodiversity destruction, et cetera, is the greatest environmental justice issue of all time.
Period. There. Period. Like, everybody take a deep breath and you know, push rewind, and it is the greatest issue of all times. It's what motivates me to be a voice for change. So the last question I'm going to ask you is, what would you give us for hope to end on a happy note? Because there are some really not good things happening out there on our planet right now and to our planet right now. What gives you hope?
Well, I think this becomes sort of a double answer. One is when you look at all the energetic and concerned people actually working to solve problems. That gives me a lot of hope. But also, if you look back sometimes, you realize that even though it's not enough, that a tremendous amount has been achieved. So back in the Amazon, you know, when I first set foot there, and it's as big as the 48 U.S. states, there was only one national park and one demarcated indigenous reserve. Today, more than 50% of the Amazon is under some form of protection, half for indigenous peoples, half in traditional conservation. So think of that. That's equivalent to half of the 48 states. It's not enough, as we were explaining, because you have to manage it as a system, but it is an astounding achievement.
It is. That's a great note on which to end. And we're winning in some of the global courts. Just getting people, indigenous people, rights to their land is a big, huge, you know, piece of progress. So, Tom Lovejoy, thank you so much. You know that I'm going to call our friend Jim and say it was a great interview. It's great to have spent this time with you, and I want to thank all our listeners. And tomorrow, our Down to Earth show, which is our local show on what's going on in and around the Southwest, Stephanie Vickers and Darian Godfrey, Trees for You and Me. And it's a program that Tucson Electric Power has started as part of Trees for Tucson's goal to plant 1 million trees in the next 10 years, which would help with our heat island significantly. And on our national show, believe it or not, November 13th, finally, Lynn Twist, one of the founders of the Pachamama Alliance, answering the call from the heart of the Amazon. So thanks for being with us. And Tom, thank you for your time. And I hope our paths cross again, like maybe in Brazil. You never know.
Look forward to it.
Had to put that little plug in there. Thanks, everybody. And just go out there and live consciously and be the change. I don't say that lightly. Thanks, everyone.